Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Teska has escaped from the Osprey, but at the cost of a severe injury. Chapter 13. Teska landed in the water just off the port side of the gig. The cold water snapped him awake, sending a wave of fresh agony through his knife wound. A pair of strong hands closed about his shoulders and hauled him out of the water. "At last," he heard Sidois mutter. "I thought he would never get down here." Giacomo laughed as he lay Teska down on a bench. "Dat be twice Giacomo be plucking you from de water, Windmaster. Who be knowin' if dere be t—" He broke off. "He be bleeding." "I'll see to that," Yvette said. "Man the oars. Get us out of here." Teska heard movement around him as Giacomo and Sidois settled themselves down on the bench and took up the oars. He felt the boat move as Giacomo pushed the gig away from the side of the Osprey. Then he heard the twin oars bite into the water and begin their rhythmic pull. "Teska," Yvette said, snapping her fingers in front of his face. "Look at me." His eyes flickered open. He could make out her face, lit by the distant glow of Maipor across the water. "Talk to me, Teska. Tell me what happened. Can you do that?"
"Stupid,"
Teska replied in a whisper.
"Pardon?"
she asked, peering at his side, trying to examine his wound in the darkness.
"I was stupid. Got past Cabot, but he threw his knife before an armor back grabbed him. Didn't think he'd do that."
Yvette shook her head.
"There's no knife in you. It must have come out when you hit the water."
She glanced up at the ship.
"At least Cabot's gone, if an armor back got him."
Teska chuckled, wincing when he felt her hand touch his side.
"No, he was ripping its legs off when I last saw him."
"La Clemence de Fille," she murmured. "What a brute."
"How's it look?" he asked.
"Can't really tell in this light," she evaded. "Keep talking to me. Why don't you tell me why Cabot hates you so much? Something about his dead brother."
Teska nodded. He knew what Yvette was doing, and it made sense to him.
"Stay conscious. Focus on something. Tell a story. Have you heard of flame wings?"
She looked puzzled.
"Those orange birds in the quad? Yes, I've heard of them."
"One of them killed his brother, but he blames me and my friend for it."
He smiled at her as she raised an eyebrow.
"It's a long story. How far away is the shore?"
She lifted her head.
"Gentlemen, we are veering to port."
There was a quiet curse from Sidois.
"You try rowing opposite someone with arms like his, little girl. Even with two good hands, you'd have the same problem."
Yvette shrugged.
"Giacomo, match your strokes to his and hold this course until we reach the shore."
"That will not take us into the harbor,"
the pirate objected. Yvette pointed towards Maipor, exasperated.
"Look for yourself, old man. The docks are lined with people watching the Osprey. If we row straight into the harbor, everyone will see us. And I cannot imagine that Ambrose Fane isn't among them. He has to be watching what's happening to his ship."
She nodded in satisfaction when Sidois did not reply.
"We'll hold this course and make landfall west of the city."
"Wait, dere be de cutlass," Giacomo said. "Eastern side of de harbor, and Giacomo no be seeing so many folk on the docks over there. Maybe we be rowing dere instead. We be among friends again." "Your friends," Sidois corrected. "Not the young ladies, and certainly not mine."
"He's right, Giacomo," Teska said. "And there are still armor backs below us. If we're out on the water too long, they'll probably capsize the gig just to find out if we're edible. Let's get to shore. We'll make our next move from there."
There was a long silence as the two oarsmen adjusted their strokes to match their efforts. Then Sidois spoke again.
"I noticed, mademoiselle, that the nets did not smell of the musk as we did. That was your doing?"
"It was," Yvette admitted. "A few gallons of seawater in each barrel diluted the mixture to a point where I didn't think it would repel the creatures."
She gave the Osprey a guilty glance over her shoulder.
"I did not expect that portion of the plan to work so well as it did."
She looked down at Teska.
"How are you feeling?"
"A little cold," Teska admitted. "The wound doesn't hurt too much, as long as I don't move."
He saw the look of concern flicker across her face and knew he'd have much the same reaction if someone else was injured and told him the same thing.
"I'll be fine until we can find a physician."
She nodded. There was really no other option. Teska tried to relax, to draw upon his training to focus past the pain, but it was far greater than the bruised ribs Ambrose had given him earlier. Every movement, even the rocking of the gig when nudged by a larger wave, sent a sharp agony through his body, and some part of him feared that if he let go completely, retreating into a half-awake delirium, he might not wake up again. The worst part was when they got to shore. As the boat bumped along the rocky beach, Tesca had to clench his teeth to hold back a groan. Giacomo and Sidois leapt into the surf and dragged the gig out of the water. Then, while Sidois and Yvette hid the boat as best they could, Giacomo carried Tesca up the beach and into the trees.
"You be resting here," Giacomo said, setting Tesca down on a stretch of flat ground.
He glanced around, then paused, looking off in one direction.
"Campfire? Maybe someone there who be giving us some help."
"No," Tesca said, grabbing the islander's arm. "Giacomo, I need you to get back to the Cutlass. Find Dutrom, tell him what's happened so far."
The islander frowned, his features barely visible in the faint light of the distant campfire.
"Dutrom? Not Keala?"
Tesca shook his head. "She should already be up at the Abbey, where she has to be."
Giacomo nodded.
"She be chasing Rex's treasure."
"Right, right," Tesca said between clenched teeth as a sharp pain ran through him.
"The treasure you know be believing in. Keala be believing?"
"I think she'd like to believe in it, but she won't let that affect her."
The wave of pain passed, and he relaxed.
"But we've still got to do what we can to help her. I need you to get to the Cutlass, as quick as you can."
The islander gave a hopeless laugh, shaking his head.
"Giacomo, no believing you here."
"You have to. You've got to let Dutrom know what happened. Ambrose will be heading for the Abbey himself. We've got to get a warning to Kerla."
Giacomo nodded toward the bay.
"Osprey's captain be dead. Ambrose be needed there, nah?"
"Maybe," Tesca agreed, "but Ambrose will only stay in my port long enough to find someone he can trust to command the Osprey in his absence."
"He no be searching for us?"
Tesca shrugged, which was about the only movement he could make that didn't make the pain worse.
"He doesn't have to look for me around here. He knows I want to get to the Abbey as well."
He sighed.
"So, we have a head start, but not much of one. The Cutlass is the closest thing we have to a home base. If we have any resources to draw upon, they come from there. So Dutrom needs to know what's happening. By now, he should have met with the Duke's commissioner in Maipur, a fellow named Montrose. If anyone can get a fast message to the Abbey, it should be him. And if everything goes wrong, at least Dutrom can take the news back to the Quad."
Giacomo gave a reluctant nod. He turned back toward the water, hearing a noise.
"The pirate and the spy be coming. Windmaster be trusting them too? It's not like I could come with you anyway. Go, before they get here."
Giacomo sighed. "Winds be keeping you safe. And you.
That we be seeing."
Then he turned and melted into the darkness. The sound of him moving off through the underbrush was quickly lost in the sound of Yvette and Sidois making their way toward Tesca from the other direction.
"Where did they go?" he heard Yvette ask.
"They have abandoned us," Sidois snapped. "I knew he was pretending to be injured."
Tesca actually laughed at that, which turned into a groan of pain.
"I'm over here," he called.
There was a change in the sound of their approach as they shifted direction, following his call, and a moment later, Yvette nearly tripped over him.
"What are you doing here alone?" she demanded. "Where's Giacomo?"
"Gone," Tesca said.
Yvette waited for him to explain, but he said nothing more.
"He abandoned you as well," Sidois spat. "That cochon. He's after the treasure. May he find his true love and lose his manhood in the next breath."
He sneered down at Tesca.
"You save him from the hungry curse that took my ship and crew, and this is how he repays you. You should choose your friends with more care, monsieur."
"The hungry curse?" Yvette asked.
"Never mind," the pirate snarled. "He must be heading for the Abbey, thinking that you would slow us down."
He leaned over Tesca.
"Did you tell him anything while you were both on that raft? Anything you haven't told us?"
"And if I did, why would I tell you?" Tesca replied. "Like as not you'd head for the Abbey and leave me behind as well."
He sighed, thinking how to proceed.
"It's true," he said, sounding frustrated. "Giacomo could be headed for the Abbey, but he doesn't know anything more about the treasure than you do. Like as not, he just decided he could make better time on his own."
Sidois shrugged, letting his frustration ebb.
Very well. Then if he is going to the Abbey, then we should find a way to get up there as well. There are farms outside of the city. Perhaps we can steal a horse.
He's not in a condition to go anywhere, Yvette snapped. The Abbey is at least a day's ride.
Then what do you suggest, mademoiselle?
Sidois sneered.
We enter the city, she said. I have some contacts there. They can arrange a physician to see to Tesca. If his partner took Grievous to the Abbey, they'll have to return to the city at some point. We can watch for them.
Too passive, the pirate retorted. Ambrose will not wait for them to come back down. He will be going up there, in force. And even if he decided to wait for them, I dare say his reach in this city is greater than those of your contacts.
Our options are limited, monsieur, she threw back. Scrambling off into the hills, unarmed, in the dark? If you truly wish to go, then go. If not, then help me get him inside the city.
The city gates will be shut, the pirate grumbled.
He turned away, as if to leave, then paused, seeing the faint light of the campfire Giacomo had seen earlier. His eyes narrowed, and the hint of a grin danced on his lips.
Wait here, he said,
suddenly moving into the trees toward the campfire.
Where are you? Yvette hissed,
but Sidois was already gone.
Oh, that arrogant fool! What is he up to?
He got some idea in his head when he saw the campfire, Tesca offered. Triad only knows what he's doing now.
Drown it all. We're not waiting for the likes of him, Yvette said. We have to get you inside the city. My contacts can get us medical care and a place to lie low. Can you walk?
If I have to, Tesca replied.
He didn't think much of trying to get inside the city after dark, but he didn't see any alternative. He didn't think Sidois acted in anyone's interest but his own. He braced himself for the agony, then forced himself to sit upright with a hiss of effort. Yvette crouched down and put one of his arms over her shoulders to help him get to his feet. They started struggling forward, Tesca grunting with each step, Yvette supporting him.
I'm surprised, he told her.
About what?
That you'd go to this trouble to bring me along. You could have just left me there like the other two.
She replied. I could have, but I've more or less abandoned my mission by helping you escape the ship. I can't go back to Grand-Père with nothing more than the little you've told me so far. If this treasure exists, we both agree that the Thanes shouldn't have it.
And the Baron wouldn't like to hear of the Duke getting it either.
At least not all of it, she said with a half-laugh. Between us, left hands, we work together for an even split. The balance between our masters remains constant.
And, Tesca added, wincing as his foot caught on a root, we ensure that they'll have enough funds to keep us both employed for years to come. Is that it?
Exactly. Wait, she said, holding him back. There are voices ahead, coming from the campfire.
Tesca lifted his head, staring toward the light.
And movement, he muttered. People coming this way.
Mad, she swore,
looking around for a place they might hide. But then they heard a louder voice calling out, and they recognized it as Sidois.
Travis! Travis! Sophie! It's all right! It's your father!
What is he doing? She hissed.
Tesca couldn't keep a grin off his face.
He's telling us what names to use, to keep our stories straight. It's the same thing I did when we met on board the Osprey.
He sagged against Yvette, the pain getting worse.
It's no good, he told her. We can't hide from him and whatever plan he's cooked up. Best to play along.
The movement ahead of them broke up into three figures, the one in front carrying a lantern.
Travis!
One of them called.
Sophie! It's all right!
Renee!
Tesca called back.
We're here!
In a moment, the beam of light turned to face them, and the figures came closer. Sidois rushed forward to hold up Tesca's other arm.
Ah, thank the Triad you are still with us, Travis! And Sophie, my child, to bring your husband so far yourself, you did not have to do that.
Tesca looked past Sidois to the two men following him. One carried the lantern and a short, heavy stick. He now turned the light outward, quickly searching in all directions, while the other, wielding a quarterstaff, guarded his back. Military training, Tesca realized, but they're wearing no livery, just white linen. Satisfied for the moment that there were no immediate dangers nearby, the man holding the lantern turned it back on Tesca. He was tall, well-muscled, with dark, close-cropped hair and suspicious eyes.
He studied Teska's side, taking note of the bloodstains spreading down his wet clothes.
From that ship in the harbor, you are.
His accent was a thick Terrandon, reminding Teska of his father.
As I said before, brother, Sidwa replied in a fearful tone, we may be her only survivors. We were coming to Maipo to visit the blessed Abbey of St. Ravino and receive healing.
Healing?
The second man barked. He was of a similar height and build to the first man, but with red hair and beard and a long, jagged scar down one side of his face.
What's wrong with you?
Sidwa displayed his maimed hand as evidence.
And my daughter, alas, is barren.
Yvette made a strangled gasp, but Sidwa sighed.
Do not be shamed by your condition, my dear. Our fellow pilgrims here, I am sure, have seen far worse.
Pilgrims, the man with the lantern repeated, looking dubious. Not wearing white?
Yes, Sidwa replied without hesitation. It was a deception by the ship's captain. May the sun strike him blind.
He sounded shamed, even angry, as he unfolded his tale.
We booked passage with him to come here, and he took us on with reluctance, for he was not of the faith. But when we arrived here late in the day and beheld the orange banners, the captain would not take us into the harbor. He said the count does not allow pilgrims to remain within his walls.
That's true enough, damn him, muttered the redhead.
Liam, said the other man, chastening him to silence.
So, why are you not wearing white?
We begged and pleaded with the captain to take us in. We could not turn away, with the city at last in sight. At length he agreed, ordering us to put on these clothes, to fool the city inspectors who were coming aboard. This we did with reluctance, but our faith could not be hidden under false clothes. Our purpose cannot be diverted. The inspectors saw through the captain's ruse and forbade us to enter the harbor that night. They also told the captain he was unwelcome in Maipo for a year and a day because of this deception. And after they left, the captain turned his wrath upon us.
Sidwa's voice became choked.
He said that we would be sold as slaves to compensate for his losses. And when he turned a lustful eye upon my daughter, Travis tried to stop him. And, as you see, he was beaten for it. By then it was too dark for the captain to sail safely out of the bay, so we remained where we were. In the night, armor backs came upon the ship, and in the confusion we made our escape. Travis was hurt by one of the monsters, while defending Sophie and myself as we scrambled into a boat.
The redhead nodded, glaring out toward the bay, as if wishing that the armor backs would dare come ashore. But the other man remained skeptical. He waved the lantern light towards Teska's bloody midsection.
Armorback did that, he asked.
Claws are strong, brother, but they don't cut. They crush.
It wasn't a claw, Teska replied, anticipating the question. Their armor comes to a point in the front. When it charged, that's what stabbed into me. I fell into the water, and my wife pulled me into the boat.
The man holding the lantern nodded, and Teska knew that had been some sort of test. This pilgrim had encountered armor backs before.
All right, then. Get you back to camp. See what can be done, son willing.
With Yvette and Sidwa supporting him, Teska was able to move through the trees more easily. They were ushered into a clearing where over a dozen tents were set up. Teska took note of their varied appearance, but also that they were arranged in ordered rows. Most of the inhabitants were awake, watching them come out of the trees, no doubt aroused by Sidwa's previous arrival and plea for help. Teska noticed at once that the pilgrims could be divided into two distinct groups. There were two more of the larger, healthy men who looked like soldiers, and then there was everyone else, the ones who more closely resembled Teska's image of a triad pilgrim. They were uniformly smaller and thinner than the soldiers, their white garments shabbier and more travel-stained. Some had crippled limbs or were missing them altogether. Others displayed boils, lesions, or other skin diseases, and some had no obvious malady other than sunken cheeks and hollow eyes. There were no small children or elderly among them. Their ages ranged from early adolescence to middle age. All watched in silence as Teska was laid down close to the campfire, their expressions a mixture of concern and curiosity. The dark-haired man knelt down beside Teska and tugged his shirt open, examining his wound with rough efficiency. Teska groaned once when the man put pressure on his abdomen.
Deep,
the man pronounced. But if anything vital had been pierced, you'd be dead already. He shook his head. See if that's a mercy or not, we will.
What do you mean?
Yvette asked, a quaver in her voice, sounding exactly like the terrified wife she was pretending to be.
I'll not lie to you, sister, the man said. Your man's young and strong, but a wound like this, sometimes that just means he lingers on longer than's best. He shrugged. But he's of the faith. We look after our own until the sun comes to claim him for the final muster.
He rose, raising his voice to reach the entire camp.
And there's no better place for him than where we're headed. His strength might keep him alive until we get there, for the sun prays him. The sun knows the value of strength.
Praise be to the sun, said the other three soldiers as one.
A few of the other pilgrims joined in the refrain a moment later, catching up.
We'll say a prayer for this one. What did you say his name was? Travis?
He gave Yvette a grim smile as she nodded.
Liam, Mixapultus, we'll do our part to keep him alive best we can.
Aye, Donal, replied the other.
As Liam entered one of the tents, Donal called to the watching pilgrims.
Gather, brethren. One of us in need of prayer there is.
Tesca, Yvette, and Sidois watched as the pilgrims who were capable of full movement came out of their tents to line up in rows. The invalids remained where they were, but they kept their eyes on Donal.
Travis, Donal said, gesturing toward Tesca. His wife and her father sought the abbey, hearing of the miracles. Like some of you here, Travis followed his family to look after them, keep them company on the journey. But the Count barred entrance to the harbour, he did, and tonight their ship was attacked by armorbacks.
There was a stirring among the pilgrims as they gave Tesca nods and looks of pity.
Armorbacks, Donal went on, his voice rising. Told they couldn't come south we were, but here they are. The plague from the elf land spreads. There's no running from the monsters.
He began to walk back and forth in front of the assembled pilgrims, meeting the eyes of each person he passed.
Killed Travis's family they would, but Travis stood his ground. He was their shield, putting himself in harm's way so that they might live, so that they might reach the abbey and be healed.
The pilgrims started to cheer in agreement with Donal's words.
We pray to the sun that Travis's sacrifice not be in vain.
Travis! The pilgrims cried out. Let Travis live! Called Donal. Let Travis live! Came the response.
Father! Guide our hearts!
Daughter! Take our pain!
Son! Donal roared.
Give us strength!
Even the invalids yelled this last response with what strength they possessed. Then all the pilgrims broke into applause, Donal beaming with pride. As the applause died down, Sidois stepped forward, his eyes brimming with tears.
You're welcome. Renews my hope, brothers,
he said, his voice cracking.
When the monsters fell upon us, I feared that all was lost. But when Travis stood against them, using himself as the shield to save my daughter, his wife, at that moment I had no fear. For I remembered.
His voice changed, becoming stronger, now with the volume and power to be heard over a storm.
And as the triad formed the world, he intoned, the father dug into the earth to raise the mountains. And as the daughter cried with joy at their labor, her tears filled the chasms left by the father's hand, and so the oceans were made. And the sun stood vigil over them, sword and shield in hand.
The pilgrims fell silent, staring at Sidois.
And the demons of the void, the pirate went on, those who coveted the darkness and the emptiness, those who hated the triad and their creation, rose from the abyss and came upon them. And the sun, sword and shield raised high, defended his family.
He bowed his head.
Thus it is written.
Thus it is written,
one of the pilgrims called out. This phrase was taken up by the others, who repeated it in low whispers. Donal watched Sidois warily, his gaze flicking back now and again to the assembly. Tesca could see he was unnerved by the pirate's words, almost excited, but he was also concerned at the effect it was having on the pilgrims.
Thus it is written, he said at last, those who stand against the rising plague of evil, to defend the family and faith, they do the sun's work. The sun grant that Travis shall stand with us once more against our enemies. But if his time has come, His sacrifice shall always be remembered. The sun marshals his troops where he will, for he has need of them in this world and the next. Praise be to the sun, the pilgrims repeated. That seemed to bring the ceremony to an end. The formation broke up, and the pilgrims began to return to their tents. Donal stepped up to Sidwa and clapped him on the shoulder. Well spoken, brother. You have more knowledge of the word than I would have thought. Sidwa made a humble shrug.
I did not hear the call as you did, brother, but I read the Book of the Triad every day.
Then he winced.
Oh, so I would, had I not been forced to flee the ship with only these clothes upon my back. There was no time to bring my copy of the book.
Donal nodded. The book is here, brother, he said, putting his palm against Sidwa's chest. And we've copies among us to share as we travel. He turned as Liam came out of the tent, carrying a small mortar and pestle, with steam rising from the stone cup. Ready?
Nearly so, the man said, walking over to Tesca. Let's get him on a litter before I apply this. We'll not want to move him after it sets.
He handed the steaming mortar to Yvette, while Donal and another of the soldiers fetched a litter from their supplies.
Surprised to see that you have a litter at hand, Sidwa commented as Tesca was lifted and placed on the litter with practiced efficiency.
There's often a few of the faithful for whom walking is a sore trial, Donal replied as Liam retrieved the mortar from Yvette. Always bring a few down from the abbey, we do. Praise the Triad for setting one aside for Travis.
Praise the Triad, Sidwa said, watching as Liam took a pinch of herbs from a pocket and added it to the thick white paste in the mortar, mixing them in thoroughly with the pestle.
Then he took several thin strips of white linen from another pocket. Handing the mortar to Yvette, he dipped each strip into the paste, thoroughly coating it, and laid them in a crisscross pattern over Tesca's wound, weaving the strips over and under to give the poultice some structure. Then he scraped the remaining paste out of the mortar into the poultice, filling in all the gaps.
"So, you make regular trips to and from the abbey?" Sidwa asked.
"Aye," Donal replied. "Make the road safe, we do, for those that hear the call, and gather more supplies for the faithful that have already assembled."
"Fascinating," the pirate murmured.
He glanced down at Tesca and Yvette, then turned away, leading Donal toward the campfire.
"I'd be very curious to hear more."
Tesca was curious as well, but he couldn't get up to follow them even if he wanted to. The poultice was not hot enough to burn him, but it made him break out in a sweat, and as his skin cooled in the night air, he started to shiver. He felt Yvette and Liam laying blankets over his chest and legs, leaving the poultice uncovered, and as his trembling subsided, Tesca also felt his wound tingling, growing numb. The pain was still there, but it was less now, and it no longer overcame his fatigue. His eyelids flickered as he looked into Yvette's face.
"Rest, my husband," she said with a sad smile. "Rest."
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. Also, if you're looking to add another podcast or two to your collection, here's one you might like. For great short stories of literary adventure fantasy, check out the Beneath Ceaseless Skies audio fiction podcast, a 2-time Parsec Award finalist, featuring short stories from the Hugo Award finalist online magazine Beneath Ceaseless Skies. To hear over 100 fantasy stories by authors such as Marie Brennan, Saladin Ahmed, and Richard Parks, read by Parsec Award finalist readers such as Rajan Khanna, Tina Connolly of Toasted Cake, and John Maher, look for Beneath Ceaseless Skies on iTunes or visit beneath-ceaseless-skies.com. And if you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.